From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made on Sunday when the 12th president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School will retire. But really, his last day is Friday. The man's going back to pack boxes after he finishes with us. It's Dr. Marvin McMickle. He served as the school's president since 2011, and his remarkable work reestablishing the institution's progressive theological education only adds to an already impressive resume. McMickle worked alongside Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Chicago during King's 1966 open housing campaign. McMickle ran for Congress twice, vying for a House seat in 1998, Senate seat in 2000, and he's well-respected across the country for his work, among other things, in social justice. As senior pastor of Antioch Baptist Church of Cleveland, he established a ministry for people infected with or affected by HIV/AIDS, the first church-based program of its kind in the country. Following his retirement, McMickle plans to stay on at Colgate as a faculty member for another year. If they'll probably convince him to try to stay longer. The school is going to be at its new location at the Village Gate, a symbolic move he is overseeing in his last days on the job, though we do hear eventually he'll get back to Cleveland. But we hope he stays in Rochester for quite a while, because I can remember the first time when I took over as host of this program in 2014, the first time Dr. McMickle was on the program, a friend of mine who was listening texted to say, "You need to have this guy on like once a week." I said, "I think he's a little too busy to do once a week, but it's been a few times, and it's nice to have you back here, Dr.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well,
appreciate it.
And, you know, do you figure, even if you're going to get back to Cleveland eventually, that you'll spend a good amount of time in Rochester in your retirement?
Well, I'm going to be teaching week intensives, which means I'll teach for 1 week a quarter. I'll just come and, you know, spend that week in town and then go back. So I don't anticipate much more than those 4 weeks interspersed over the course of the next calendar year.
Okay, and you're literally packing boxes this afternoon?
I just washed the dust off my hands to come to be with you.
You are very kind to share what is a very, very busy week for you. How are you feeling in your last week of the job at Colgate?
You know, I have mixed emotions. It is time for me to go. I'm 70 years old, and I've had some real serious health challenges over the last 2 or 3 years, which were largely driven by the pace at which the work of a divinity school president operates, both on the campus and on the road. A lot of time is spent with alumni, with donors, with institutional relations. So I spend as much time in hotels and airports and convention centers as I did on campus. It's all very exciting, but it's also very wearing. And so I'm ready to shift gears.
When you look back at your time, especially at Colgate, what's the most important piece of work or idea that you helped shepherd?
Well, I think the school had been talking about relocating and getting out of the real estate business and getting back into the core business of theological education for the last 25 years. The building was constructed in 1928. It was designed for a residential campus. We no longer have a substantial number of residential students. It's a 24-acre campus. Most of our budget was designed to simply maintain the facility, and it was a bad act of stewardship. So to get the school to move, to relocate, to refocus on our core mission, to think about how to adapt into distance learning and online learning, to reaffirm our progressive theological agenda so that we do not get morphed into this ever more conservative view of the world that many of my co-religionists have, I think is important. There need to be places like Colgate and Union Seminary in New York and a few other places that are just unashamedly, unabashedly progressive in their way of reading Scripture and of talking about the role of the church in society.
Well, and, you know, it's fascinating. You have not shied away at all from talking about politics, talking about race, talking about social issues. Can I read a little bit of an op-ed that you wrote for the Democrat and Chronicle
Sure.
in October under the title, "Evangelical Has a New Meaning"? I'm going to read from this. This is what Dr. McMickle wrote. Quote, "Evangelical," and this is a lengthy read here, but I think it's worth exploring here. Quote, "Evangelical is a valid theological term that has absolutely nothing to do with the 21st century political agenda. Evangelicals believe in the divinity of Jesus, the authority of Scripture, the sinful nature of humanity that can be redeemed through grace, the work of global evangelization, and the separation of church and state. Sadly, in the hands of certain white conservative Christians, the term evangelical has been appropriated and almost redefined into a political agenda that has nothing to do with Jesus or the Bible. White evangelical Christians are responsible for the election of Donald Trump. They ignored, overlooked, or sought to explain away his obvious moral flaws and his numerous sexual assaults because he promised to shift the balance of the U.S. Supreme Court that would result in overturning Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to make choices regarding reproduction. Those largely white conservative Christians have made a deal with the devil. They are hoping to gain something that comes at the risk of losing their souls. The debacle involving the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to serve in the Supreme Court is part of this corruption of the meaning of being an evangelical. The news media has contributed to this problem by constantly talking about what evangelical Christians believe. What they should say is what some politically conservative Christians believe. Being an evangelical has nothing to do with values voters or the moral majority or the Republican Party as hijacked by Donald Trump. End quote. Strong words, the risk of losing their souls in supporting this president. But you're someone who still chooses words carefully, don't you?
Oh, yes. Every word of that I would stand by today. I do not know how people who 20 years ago were talking about family values and talking about the importance of morality in national leaders and were banging away at what they believed to be the inappropriate behavior of Bill Clinton with Monica Lewinsky and sexual activities, how they could on a dime 20 years later move in the direction in which they have. And I think it's pretty clear. They have made a deal. If he will appoint conservative judges, if they can perhaps get Roe v. Wade overturned, they're going to look the other way, except for Jerry Falwell Jr., who says that he believes that God has ordained that Donald Trump be the president. That's crazy, and it's frightening.
Well, let me offer sort of a very amateur perspective on this. And this is not talking about all of the voters who supported and support Donald Trump. It's looking at evangelicals. I think the grail for them is abortion. And I think it matters so much more than anything else that to them the ends justify the means. And they may be on track. I mean, in many ways they are on track already. We are seeing changes at the state levels.
Sure.
And it won't be long before the Supreme Court will find a case.
Yeah, there'll be a case.
And so in this sense, to some who self-identify as evangelicals, though, again, we'll talk in a moment about why you think that term is overused, especially in the media. But I think that's what this is. I think that they view that as so far above anything else that they are willing to because the ends justify the means.
If that is their view, it is understandable. Then just say it is a conservative political consideration that is trying to organize the political apparatus in such a way as to overturn Roe v. Wade. Let's leave the word evangelical and the word Christian out of it because there's no straight line from your starting point to your conclusion. Evangelicals are not, as a group historically, committed to a political ideology. As a matter of fact, the history of evangelicalism is to drive the separation of church and state, not so much to keep the church away from political activity, but to keep the operation of the government away from too much intrusion into the life of the church. And I think that those lines have been badly obscured over the last 10 or 12 years. It didn't just start with Donald Trump. This started in the 1980s with the moral majority. This started with the takeover of school boards and city councils and state legislatures, the reapportionment of congressional districts that have resulted in Republican-safe districts all over the country. And it has just worked its way up. And I think that if the Democratic Party or any other party wants to match the power and strength of the current Republican apparatus, you can't start with the White House.
Isn't that so interesting? Yeah. We've got about 700 candidates for president on the Democratic side.
Yeah.
And everyone just wants to go straight to the top.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Republicans are winning at
every level. Yeah.
And boy, are they good.
That's the design. That started in the 70s into the 80s. I mean, it was very intentional. They started with smaller levels of political activism, got a foothold there, went up, climbed the ladder, so that by the time presidential politics kicked in, there was an apparatus beneath them that was really formidable. And that's what drove every Republican president from Nixon right on up to the current occupant, is grassroots political activism and organization. You got to give them credit.
Oh, no, cool question.
For the mastery of that process.
There's no question.
And the patience that it took to just build your base until today.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, right now, the Democrats, I mean, if you're a Democrat and you can bake a pan of brownies without burning it, you're apparently qualified to run for president. Forget Senate.
Yeah.
Forget Congress. Forget local elections. Forget city councils. It's a school board.
That's where it started.
Yeah, it is a very interesting dynamic as we see it there. And when it comes to the way voters talk about themselves as evangelicals, let me ask you, you know, sort of the more theological side of this, right? Why is it that you think someone like Jesus of Nazareth, who, to the extent that we historically know, and I mean, I'm trying to talk about actual record, historical record, to the extent that we know about who he was as a person, we certainly know that he would not have been a wealthy person. And whether you're a Christian or not, whoever's listening to this broadcast right now, whatever, if you're an atheist, if you're Jewish or Muslim or Christian or Buddhist or Hindu, whatever the case may be, you can read the surviving ideas of mm-hmm. whoever Jesus was as a person. Mm-hmm. And there are some beautiful ideas there.
Yeah.
And they do not talk about prosperity gospel, driving luxury cars, building up walls of country clubs. This was not a person who would have been a member at Oak Hill. Or I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate the Oak Hills of the world, but I'm just pointing out that Jesus as a person, to the extent that we know about the historical record, was so different than what many sort of self-identified white evangelicals are today. How do you think that has happened? Why do you think they identify with Jesus, who as a person was so different than who they are?
Well, let's dig into your observation, because it is an excellent one. One of the alums of Colgate back in the 1920s was Howard Thurman, famous African-American theologian, and he wrote a book called Jesus and the Disinherited, in which he made the point that Jesus was a person who was born on the margins of society. He was a poor Jewish person living in a Roman-dominated culture, and so his worldview was shaped by his socio-political position. Growing out of that came all the liberation theology movements that say you are not really a Christian if you are not deeply committed to the problems of the poor and the causes of poverty in our world. The Peruvian theologian Gustavo Gutierrez says, if you ignore the issues of poverty, it's because you're not paying attention, because it is obvious and conspicuous. How have we jumped from Jesus pointing us to the least of these? I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked, I was sick, to a $65 million airplane so you can travel the world to, quote unquote, evangelize. I think it's the capitalization of the Christian church. Things began to change really about 320 AD when Constantine merged the church and the state, and all of a sudden, status became as important as service. And it's just evolved ever since. You have to fight to get people to serve. If you say, I want to, award you something, or I want to give you some prominent position, folk will stand in line for the honors. But if you say, let's go out and feed people who are gathered in a park because they're homeless, let's sacrifice from our budget. When I was a pastor in Cleveland, our commitment was that we wouldn't just ask folks to tithe 10% to the church. We required that the budget tithe 10% out to the neighborhood to impact the people who were living around us, most of whom had no connection to the church whatsoever. I couldn't get many other churches to buy into that, but it is my worldview, it is my philosophy, it's my concept that we are measured by how much we give, not how much we aspire to gain.
Can I interrupt for one moment? On that subject, there's this fascinating a conversation that's becoming an international conversation about philanthropy. And to boil the argument down, it says essentially this. individual philanthropy cannot save structural inequality. Mm-hmm. That acts people like Robert Smith, who is going to pick up the loan debt for 396 graduates, African American graduates. That is a tremendous act of individual philanthropy by a person, by the way, who has spent many years opposing the kinds of laws that would get him to pay the same level of taxes as probably you and I pay. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't want to pay taxes. He doesn't trust the government with tax money, but he wants individually to do it. Now, for those 396 students, that's great, but there's probably 396,000 students who need the help.
Sure.
And individual philanthropy is important, but how do you couple individual charity or individual philanthropy with structural reform?
Sure. That's where the advocacy comes in. That's where you're trying to move the dial on people in government or in private industry who do have the wherewithal to either increase wages or to provide benefits or to, you know, stop polluting the atmosphere, whatever the case may be. But it seems to me that they both come out of the same initial impulse. You have an interest in things beyond yourself. Once you can say, I'm not in this world to benefit myself. I'm in this world to be a blessing, to be a benefit to the broader culture. And there are a variety of ways by which I can do that. Some is individual advocacy, individual philanthropy. Some is, yesterday I went to vote along with 13% of the Rochester community. 13%.
13%.
So we're complaining about the school board. We're complaining about the judges. We're complaining about everything. And 13% of the population goes to vote on these important areas. So there are lots of things that we need to do, and we need to do them on a consistent basis.
Let me get our first phone call. It's Rich in Rochester. I'm with Dr. Marvin McMichael. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan. How are you doing today?
Very good, sir.
I just want to comment on, you made the point about abortion and that being the lightning rod. I think abortion has been used as the red herring, but I truly believe this, the right and the evangelical right is driven by racism. I do not, I look at the history, I look at the roots of it. You're talking about a Republican Party taken over by Southern segregationists. They started their Southern strategy. Everything that you look at outside of that one little thing they advocate for doesn't advocate for people. They don't advocate for birth control. They don't advocate for sex education. They don't advocate for anything that will stop the numbers of abortions. So I think that is just the red herring. In the end, it's about power. It's still about segregation. And I think that's the part that people don't want to face. There's only one war in this country that killed 700,000 U.S. citizens. There's only one thing that did it, and it was racism and slavery. And I think that's so endemic. I think that is, I hate to use this term, but I don't think there's anything more American than racism. And I think that's what drives this all.
Rich, as always, thanks for the phone call. Dr. McMichael.
Yeah, I mean, I think he touches on Jim Wallace's book, America's Original Sin, which is racism. Jim Wallace of Sojourners Magazine. No, I think he's touched on an important point. I think there are several lightning rods in the current American milieu. Racism is its oldest one, but I do not want to get too far away from the fact that there is still a battle over this issue of a woman's right to choose. So I would say that he is correct historically in the long run, but underneath that broad umbrella, there is, I think, a real moral outrage, even among people, even some African-American people for whom racism clearly would not be a defining issue, who simply have made up their mind that abortion is an act of murder and that every child ought to be born. Now, the last part of his comment, I think, is telling, which is, all right, if you have a right-to-life philosophy, then it cannot stop in the birth room. Right to life means right to health care, right to a quality education, right to clean air, right to not be guided in a way that's going to result in prison and incarceration. My frustration with this right to life movement is you insist that every child be born, but then you do not advocate for those programs and policies that make the quality of life meaningful across the board. So how do you have every child must be born and 2 million plus people who are incarcerated, most of whom are there for reasons that are almost inevitably linked to a lack of economic opportunity at some point along the way?
Yeah, and you know, when you see research data regarding to use just a term, mostly predominantly black churches when it comes to abortion, you're right. There's mm-hmm. plenty of opposition to abortion within black churches. There has been a pretty strong anti-LGBTQ movement mm-hmm. among really American Christianity, with some exceptions, and certainly in what we would probably identify as black churches. How do you rate the work of, is this an overgeneralization, or how do you rate the work of black churches in terms of seeing some of the progressive values that you see in your Christian roots?
It's miserable. With the single exception of racism, which is what universally impacts black people, once you get away from issues of race relations and talk about women in ministry, talk about LGBT quality of life, talk about abortion, that community becomes as socially conservative as almost any other place in the country. There's a passage where Paul in Galatians 3 says, neither male nor female, neither slave nor free, neither Jew nor Gentile. So Paul is identifying the great social divide of the ancient world, race, class, and gender. All right, most black churches would fight to the death over this slave and free piece. When it comes to Jew and Gentile or male and female, in this city, in Rochester right now, there are churches that would never consider a female pastor. There are churches that would never consider an LGBT person in any leadership role if they were public about their identity. No, I think the black church has nothing to boast about when it comes to these two issues.
Daniel writes to the program saying, overturning Roe may be the grail, but it's so much bigger than that. Marriage equality, adoption, access to social services, school choice, quote, law and order, and Christian dominionism. These are the things evangelicals in power hope to control. Federal judges with lifetime appointments will do more to shift our society than anything else. Elections have consequences, for sure, and Republicans have done very well with that, and they're in many ways very pleased with what we've seen in the judicial and many levels. And wouldn't you say?
I mean, I think that's the point. The election of Donald Trump was much less about Donald Trump and about the power to shape the judiciary from the Supreme Court level to appeals courts to federal district courts, and then in partnership with Mitch McConnell to hold an Obama nomination, to hold it, to say we shouldn't vote on this in an election year, and then to say, but if one became vacant in this election cycle, well, of course, we would fill it right away. So the partnership between a Republican Senate and a Republican White House has really shaped the judiciary for the next 30 to 40 years.
Well, when Daniel talks about marriage equality, and you brought up LGBTQ rights, I want to ask you if you've seen your own views evolved, and if so, what happened to make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in an era in Chicago when the issue was never discussed. You know, gay and lesbian issues were simply not on our agenda. And so I sort of grew up with the standard assumption that, you know, people who are inclined toward a certain female behavior or were, women who were sort of mannish was an oddity. I even preached once, terrible, I confess my sin publicly. I even preached a Mother's Day sermon at Abyssinian Baptist Church in 1973, in which I said, now this is the day that differentiates women from those men who want to be, that, you know, that you cannot physically bear a child. Oh, and the church had a considerably large number of gay and lesbian members. And I didn't know how to be a pastor to them at that time. And the feedback from that, both from the pastor of the church and the members, really forced me to, you know, stop and think about what it was I was doing. But the reading of the scripture, meeting people within that community, and recognizing that, first of all, I do not know whether this is a biological or a behavioral phenomenon, whether this is the way a person is born or a choice that a person has made. So over time, and I tell you, over time is like for the last 45, nearly 50 years, my views on that have evolved to the point that I'm now, as strong an advocate for LGBTQIA, the continually evolving descriptor as there is, because I'm atoning for my own sin in the past and recognizing that a lot of folk are still where I was.
Before I get to your phone calls, just to add to that, you are a very influential voice in our community, one of the respected leaders in our community, and you're standing up to say, I was wrong.
Yeah.
One of my concerns in hosting this program is I see fewer people willing to admit when they were wrong or when their views changed. I find tremendous power in saying, I don't know, or I was wrong, or you've convinced me.
Yeah.
I find that to be thrilling, but lately it just feels less and less so. And some of your work, a lot of your work, I think, focuses on the Christian roots of social justice mm-hmm. and what that truly means. I think even for those who might think the cause of social justice has tremendous merit, I'm a little concerned that when people are identified as not being woke enough, not having had a view that's sort of outside of what is desired, or having in the past made statements, I am not at all saying that we shouldn't have consequences for our actions. But sometimes I feel like it's a little bit about point scoring and drawing lines and drawing teams as opposed to showing grace and trying to work together mm-hmm. and allowing doors to open. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, one of our professors, every fall and spring, we have a series of lectures, and every fall and spring, one of them is devoted to the LGBTQ conversation. And so we had one just, I think, in April. And one of our professors had performed a same-gender marriage some years ago. And when asked about it, her answer was, her name is Gail Ricciuti, her answer was, I want to go before God. I'd rather explain why I was as open as I was to people as opposed to why I was so closed in my understanding of things. I'm with Gail. I'd rather stand before God and say, Lord, my sense of you is that you are inclusive and open and welcoming and receiving, not that you are barring the door and, saying only these can proceed. I think at some point you just have to take a stand and say, this is where I am. This is what I believe. Other folks may not believe what it is that I'm proclaiming to you, but I've arrived at this point and I'm not going to go back.
Can you forgive people for, in the past, holding views that you would find aberrant?
You have to. You have to. Now, the question is, have they evolved on those views?
I think that really is the question.
Yeah.
It's not just sort of forgiveness for forgiveness' sake.
Right.
It's is there real contrition and understanding?
Yeah. Right? Have you moved from that, please forgive me for what I said or did then, I am a different person now? Because I believe that if I can't forgive those who've evolved over time from where they were, how do I expect God to forgive me for my movements?
Linda in Webster, next on the phone with Dr. Marvin McMickle. Linda, go ahead.
Hello. I just wanted to wish Reverend McMickle well. I read your op-eds all the time, and I'm always in concurrence with what you say. And Cleveland is getting a real gem for sure. I'm very happy. And I guess pursuant to the topic that you all are talking about, I wonder what Reverend McMickle might like to offer a comment on in terms of the polarization that's happening in our country and how to have conversations that are not acrimonious with people who may disagree with what you have to say. So that's all I have to say, and good luck with everything, Reverend McMichael.
Well, thank you very much for your comments and for your affirmation. I really appreciate it. I think the thing that we were just saying, the ability to confess that you have not always been right, the ability of others to acknowledge that they are in movement in their views, and that movement is legitimate and sincere, and not just, you know, I'm going to become a temporarily progressive in order to win an election, and then, you know, go back to where I was, so that in the last election cycle, all of these conservative people were saying, well, of course we have to have a health care program that takes care of pre-existing conditions during the election cycle. And then once they get elected, they go right back to let's repeal Obamacare and, you know, sort of forget all of that. I think tolerance, patience, and understanding that everybody has a basis for their view. Find out what it is that makes them think or feel the way that they do. But you don't have to argue all the time in order to be heard or to be understood. But you do have to be persistent. What I've discovered over the years is you can't say anything about justice once. You can't stand up for the truth today. You know, if you are a writer, as I have been over the years, and you start writing these blogs and these op-eds, people are looking now for a certain consistency in your pattern. And if all of a sudden what they thought was a progressive theological or progressive social ideology takes a sudden U-turn on a topic that seems out of character, folk will lose confidence in you. So, you know, once you start down a path, mm-hmm. you've got to stay there. And when folks say, well, now you've gone too far, well, too far for you maybe, but not too far for me.
And I think to kind of follow up on Linda's question, it can be really tough at times to have conversations with your family, particularly, and I'll just say this, if you're someone who is sort of outside the consequences of oppression in any sense. Mm-hmm. And if you hear a family member making a remark, the easy thing to do is sort of sit back and, you know, the old saw about, you know, the Thanksgiving table and everything. Yeah. Well, you know, well, yeah. No politics. I don't believe that, but my view is to say to someone, if they're saying something that I think is aberrant or wrong or hurtful, I love you and I'm going to keep loving you. Yeah. But here's why I think you're wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, not coming in saying, look, you're out of my family. I'll never talk to you again.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to kind of persistently say, no, this is not okay. And to also say, my mind is open to change here if you can convince me, but I can't sit here and listen to this. I want you to know that I love you and here's why I think you're wrong.
Yeah.
And that can be hard to do for people.
It can be hard to do. It can be hard to say and it can be hard to hear.
Yeah.
But risking saying the truth is the first act of kindness. It's the first act of justice. I've got a series of books I've written over the years, one of which is entitled Be My Witness. It's based on a text in the book of Acts. And I take this word witness and I say, now there are three ways to understand what it means to be a witness. The first is to see something. So that a witness, I saw that, I'm paying attention to that. The second is to say something about what you have seen, which becomes riskier because now you're identifying where you stand. And the third, the Greek word for witness is martyria, which is the basis for the English word martyr. So that in a sense, Jesus is saying to the disciples, be my martyr. Be prepared to suffer something for the sake of what you say because of what you have seen. If you go all the way with that, you are free. If you're not afraid to suffer a little something, lose a friend, have a negative comment said about you, then you've made the journey. Most folks don't want to see. They just turn their head. If they see, they don't want to say because they're afraid of identifying their conviction. And if they say it, they're really afraid of the suffering of it. So just leave it alone.
My guest, Dr. Marvin McMickle, is retiring as president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School. He is literally in the midst of packing boxes and popping over to WXXI to give himself a lunch break and a conversation break. We have had so many conversations over the years. After our only break of the hour, we're back to your phone calls and emails. And I will ask Dr. McMickle, in the spirit of what he just said, has he lost friendships or had difficult relationships with, you know, certainly leaders in power in our community who maybe don't like to hear the views that he as the leading voice in our community has espoused over the years. Much more to come with him after our only break here. Coming up in our second hour, President Trump says he will win re-election against whomever the Democrats choose. But we'll talk this hour, coming up, about what Democrats can do to seize the opportunity. The president's approval ratings are historically low. And there does seem to be a big open window. But should the Democrats, quote, play it safe and nominate someone like Joe Biden? Or is this time for a different kind of consideration? We'll discuss it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Linda writes to say, Evan, I am making brownies right now as you speak about the ability to make brownies without burning them as being the only Democratic prerequisite for running for president this year. I never really thought about running, but you never know. Linda, get in there. There's still time. We'll get you on the debate stage. Next hour, by the way, Dr. McMickle, we're talking to a panel responding to a piece in Politico this week from Charlie Sykes. Charlie is a conservative broadcaster and commentator who would like to see President Trump lose.
Yes, I know who he is.
But his concern is the Democrats are going to blow this.
They might.
And what he wants is Democrats to get away from social justice issues, get away from things like discussing reparations, track to the middle, maybe nominate someone quote-unquote safe like Joe Biden. What would you say to Charlie
Sykes? Well, I think that he's right. I'm terribly
afraid.
You think
he's right?
I think he's right.
I can't believe I'm hearing you say this. Yeah. That's not what I expected.
Yeah. I think that there's a great chance that the Democratic Party will blow this. That they will.
But you're talking about being bold and talking about social justice, and he's saying if you do that, you'll lose.
What I'm saying is that in a primary, it is a possibility that this is the same thing that happened with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. They killed each other in the primary, and they were so wounded going into the fall election that she was limping when the campaign started. There are too many people in this race. Tonight and tomorrow night, there will not be enough time for them to differentiate themselves. I hope that as the process unfolds, and either because of fundraising or because of whatever the polls are, that list gets trimmed pretty quickly. There are people who are trying to run for president who really have no reason to do that except that they think this is an opportunity for them to do so. My suspicion is that any of them, from my point of view, will be markedly better than the present occupant of the White House. So for that reason, because I so desperately want to see a change in the White House, I do not want to see the Democratic Party blow this, and I hope that they will not.
So I'll just ask you directly, do you think Elizabeth Warren could beat President Trump?
Oh, sure. If she could get to the general election, she could.
She could.
She could, yeah.
The argument of the Charlie Sykes of the world is if you nominate someone like Elizabeth Warren, you're going to lose.
No, I think that she is getting away from just, sort of left-wing politics. I think she's got a base that she could run from. I think, of course, Joe Biden has the best chance of doing it. I do not think that Bernie Sanders can, because he has sort of self-identified with a term, which even though he keeps trying to explain it to people, democratic socialism, Trump will use that last word, socialism, and just beat him to death with it. But too many candidates, not enough time for differentiation.
Well, and before I jump back to the phone calls, one more point on that. I mean, I think when you say Elizabeth Warren is getting away from what people sort of stereotype as left-wing politics, what I find interesting is when you watch her talk to town halls, and I watched Bernie Sanders' town hall on Fox News, by the way, they have moved in a direction of saying to voters, look, you are conservatives. I understand that. Here's why I think you've been getting the bad end of it. And here's why what we are proposing is good for workers, it's good for Americans, as opposed to come join us on the left wing.
Yeah.
I find that way more effective than dividing into teams here.
Yeah.
And I am starting to see, because whoever the next Republican candidate who's not named Donald Trump will, or at least Donald Trump, claimed to want to be talking to all of America or the forgotten voices. I mean, we could sort of parse all of that. But I think this notion of just join the team here as opposed to, look, if you're hurting, I don't care what your politics are. This is why this is better.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
is more effective.
Yeah, and I think people are looking for someone who has a plan, who has a history of political activity, so they understand how the apparatus in Washington works. They have some concept of what life is like for the average person. I think Charlie Sykes, by the way, on more than one occasion, I've agreed with Charlie Sykes.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope we as Americans who have different political views can occasionally find common ground.
Yeah, yeah. That he is separating himself from his president and his party, I always find refreshing. That the Republicans can say, all right, this may sound odd to you, but I do not agree with what our political leader is doing.
Back to the phones. Jane in Rochester. Next, on with Dr. Marvin McMichael. Go ahead, Jane.
Okay, I've got a couple of things to say, but when you say moving back away from the left, Elizabeth Warren has going for her is that she is not a corporate Democrat in the eyes of a lot of us. And so that seems contradictory to me. If she were to move to the right, I wouldn't be interested in her at all. I don't see her as moving to the left. But I wanted to ask a question, and that is about the Democrats and their... It seems like we don't jump in there and use the bully pulpit or make that opportunity to use it as effectively as sometimes the Republicans do. And, of course, they talk trash, and we're trying to get through that, but we don't seem to do that. And back in the 60s, look at who we had. Martin King, JFK wasn't bad in reaching people on all levels. We had those sorts of people to more or less... We felt in the same room with them, and they were talking to us. And in Martin King's case, he was a poet. We don't seem to have that. The closest that comes to it is Elizabeth Warren as far as being rightly angry at what's been done to all of us. So could you tell in this short time what you think we might do to better connect with people and let them better know what we are about, as Martin King and, as I said, sometimes JFK did with his eloquence? Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, it's a great insight. A little righteous indignation goes a long way. And James Baldwin said back in the 1960s that if you are in America and you're not in a constant state of rage, you aren't paying attention. There is so much to be upset and angry about. To think about what's happening at the southern border, to think about what's happening with these children in these detention camps, to think about the idea of cutting health care for millions of Americans with no plan to replace it, to think about teasing out a war with Iran over their nuclear program after you have pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, to think about concerns about the environment after you pulled out of the Paris Accords, to talk about better relationships with Korea and Japan and China after you get out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This makes absolutely no sense. So there's enough to be angry about. What we lack, I think, and she's trying to say this, is an articulate and compassionate spokesperson. For whatever you might have said about them, both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were very effective communicators of a coherent message. There are too many voices talking to try to get our attention in the Democratic Party. So I think she's got a good point. We need a little passion. Nancy Pelosi is our strongest person in terms of the Speaker of the House. But she's not running for a national office. She's in one. And she's a very careful politician, but she's not a real firebrand.
Is there a single candidate running right now that you would like to see elected?
Like to see elected, or of those who are there, would prefer to be elected.
Yeah.
I like Kamala Harris a great deal. I do not know that she will make it. I think Joe Biden is the person to beat because of history and credibility. Though as his history comes up, you see, Joe Biden has a long record, and the crime bill and some other things that he was a part of earlier could come back to haunt him. But I think, you know, he speaks to a certain constituency. He's got a certain level of credibility. He doesn't have to introduce himself like so many of the other ones do. So I think he may be an inevitable candidate. I think Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris are really good candidates. I would love to see a woman emerge as our nominee. I think that a woman nominee against Donald Trump, who has seen what happened to Hillary Clinton and can play it a little differently, would be very effective.
Now, some listeners, especially conservative listeners, are going to say, well, Evan, aren't you going to do a show with local conservative leaders or what Republicans need to do to win in 2020? And the answer is yes, but it's also harder to get conservatives to kind of talk about it right now. And I'll give you an example. Just last night, on primary night, you had Bill Napier, who is the new head of the local Republican Party, and Bill's a guy I know who's worked in a lot of different campaigns, former deputy county executive, extremely smart guy. And Bill, if you're listening, I'd love to have you on the program here. So let's see if we can schedule that. But he was talking about linking Adam Bellow, who's running for county executive, to Albany Democrats, which I understand that's part of what happens in politics, and some of that may well be fair. But when Veronica Volk, our reporter, asked the county executive, Cheryl Donolfo, about her own views of President Trump, she would not answer the question, would not answer whether she supports the president, didn't want to talk about it. I think those questions are fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to Dr. McMichael's point earlier, when you have a party that is as good as the Republicans are at politics, they're so good. They win elections at the local level. They dominate state houses. So it's not just the presidency. But that's how you build this foundation. And I think it's fair to ask someone that question. So two things to you here. Do you think those questions are fair? Is it fair to ask Cheryl Donolfo if she supports Donald Trump? And have you had relationships impacted or injured by your own outspoken progressive advocacy?
Yes and yes. Cheryl Donolfo is in a Republican Party that has a national apparatus. What happens at the national level impacts a lot of things in Monroe County. It's important for the voters to know what she believes and where she stands in relationship to national policy. Yes, and the vast majority of black churches in Rochester have not invited me to come to preach because of my views on women in ministry and because of my views on the LGBT issue. And they have made that perfectly clear. And they have chosen not to enroll at Colgate Rochester Divinity School because they do not want to be exposed to instruction that puts those topics in a positive light. So, yeah, I don't know how many white churches have not invited me because of that. But I know that there are any number of African-American clergy for whom I am a persona non grata.
When it comes to political leadership, you know, you've been part of things like RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Of course, we have local political leaders who have worked in various ways with those efforts. When you are behind closed doors, are you a little more free to be blunt? Because we all try to get along as best we can in public and in private. But what are those conversations like?
Yeah, see, that's where I think politics ought to operate. This world of tweeting every thought that crosses your mind is crazy. There are things that happen at RMAPI, votes that are taken, points of view that are expressed, obstacles that we have to overcome that we're not going to, call a press conference. We're going to go to the person. We're going to talk to them about the policy changes, which if they would operate, for instance, there are 10,000 home health care workers in Monroe County, mostly African-American women with children, who are not making enough money on any of their three jobs to get beyond the poverty level. If we could get the agencies that hire them, hospitals and private companies that employ and deploy home health care workers and give them a living wage, we could impact poverty in Monroe County by 50%. Now, everybody knows that is true, that an increased wage for people who are working two and three jobs with no benefits, that's the path out. But to get people to talk about a wage increase and to do it, we don't get enough funding from Albany, we don't get enough money from Medicare reimbursement. There's always a reason not to do it. But if you want to get it done, don't embarrass them in public. Talk to them privately. Hear them out and make a case for it. Embarrass them last of all. I'll embarrass you, but that's after I've tried everything else.
Last minute with you. You're leaving Rochester. We hope we'll see you around occasionally, but you're going to spend a lot of your time in retirement in Cleveland. When you think back of Rochester, especially on these beautiful summer days, what's a spot of peace in this city, a place where you can go and be quiet and reflect, maybe with a cup of coffee or maybe just with your thoughts, that you will miss when you think about Rochester?
Well, of course, the banks of the Genesee River are beautiful. The Finger Lakes are gorgeous. But I'll tell you the truth. I have spent the last 8 years living in what I think is one of the most beautiful places in Rochester, which is the hill where Colgate is located. We're up on a bluff We can look out in every direction and see downtown, see the southern tier. I will miss the campus of Colgate, 24 acres of flowing hills and trees, and the landscaping is gorgeous. I mean, I could just go out on the front porch. The president's house is on the campus. I can go on the front porch and think I'm in another world. I will miss the campus, but it's time to go.
I will miss the conversations with you here.
Thank you.
And I hope somehow in the future we can rearrange schedules to get back together, but I wish you well.
Thank you.
And I say that, listeners, I want to be clear, not always because my viewpoints are not relevant here. What I respect is someone who is as boldly forceful but kind and compassionate as someone like you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk to his successor in the coming weeks
please.
As well.
Yeah, please do.
And
yeah.
We look forward to talking to your successor, Angela Sims,
yeah.
In the coming weeks. But that is Dr. Marvin McMickle, the outgoing president of Colgate, Rochester, Crozier Divinity School. He's going back to pack up some boxes. We'll give him a little space to do that. Friday is his last day.
Last day.
More connections coming up.